just start by saying briefly what the intention is for this course? So because you've had the course by Professor Wen, and that was an extremely interesting course. But it didn't touch on many of the sort of basic ideas of condensed matter physics. So in some sense, this is a course which could have been taught before Professor Wen's course. In fact, you might even argue that a course like this would fit into the core of the PSI program. And the intention is to acquaint you with the basic notation, the terminology, and some of the concepts in condensed matter physics. And because condensed matter physics is such a vast subject, I decided to focus down on one particular fraction of the vast subject, a vast fraction, which is basically systems that are, we call metals. Okay. So the plan for the course, if we, depending on how things work, is that in the first week, we're going to talk about the properties of normal metals. In the second week, we're going to discuss the theory of conventional superconductors. And in the third week, hopefully, we'll talk about the theory of unconventional metals and superconductors. So that's the plan. So let me begin by talking about the basic problem. And the basic problem is to derive the properties of matter based on a particular theory, which Bob Laughlin describes as the theory of everything. Now that's, I think he goes on to say something like it's the theory of everything that we actually care about. But you guys might not feel the same way. And so the theory of everything is based on a Hamiltonian, which has kinetic energy of electrons. Kinetic energy of nuclei, the interactions between the electrons and the nuclei, particularly challenging problem, the interactions of the electrons with each other, and okay, and the interactions of the ions with each other, or the nuclei with each other. Okay, so minus E and M are the charge and mass of the electron. In general, total generality, in fact, the electrons are light, the nuclei are heavy, and the systems are neutral, okay? Because if they're not neutral, then all kinds of things happen. It's a totally non-relativistic theory, or it's a non-relativistic theory, I should say, to a good approximation. This theory describes an enormous range of phenomena. It describes atoms, for instance, hydrogen, molecules, also gases and liquids. And solids, for that matter. Describes metals, insulators, and semiconductors. Describes magnets, superfluids, superconductors, crystals, glasses, polymers and plastics, liquid crystals, cells, and other organisms. Bacteria, viruses, plants, animals, planets, stars, a wide range of phenomena. And it's all contained here. You don't actually need anything else other than this Hamiltonian and the fundamental properties of the elementary particles, like their quantum statistics and so forth. Yes, Eric.
So you said that this Hamiltonian describes plants. Is that like in the same sense that like quantum field theory describes plants? Or like can you actually extract easily information about plants from this Hamiltonian?
I would say that you can get to here from quantum field theory.
Right, the point is like... Right.
So you can just keep going, But the point is that you don't have to, you can start from here and do all of those things. I mean, maybe the next thing that I'm going to say, I don't know, possibly addresses what's concerning you, which is that this is a strongly interacting many-body system, and it cannot just be solved. You cannot say, okay, I'm going to calculate the behavior of a bacterium, starting from here, even though you know how many you can guess, surmise how many electrons are there, what nucleons are there, and so forth. You know, just put everything into the pot. Okay, but you can't actually do that calculation because this is a humongously complicated and extremely strongly interacting. Particularly, this I should say, it's particularly a horrendously strongly interacting problem if you start looking at pieces of it at a time. Okay, so I mean, if you look at any of these terms, like this one, there's enormous energies in a system which seems quite benign, and it's only when you add these things together and then describe them in the proper way, that there's any hope of getting out all of these things, which we know come out. Okay. So what's the point of this? I mean, if anyone told you that if you just knew the basic interactions and the particles, and then it was just computation to get out everything that follows from that, you should believe that that's not true. It will be many of our lifetimes, many successive lifetimes before, it's not an easy problem. Okay, I should add that it's not even an easy problem. I mean, there's a big simplification that you can make at step one, which is for solid materials. You could combine a lot of these electrons with the nucleons to make ions, where practically all of the electrons would be tightly bound up in the ions. And so instead of having nuclei, you would have ions, which maybe have a charge of one or two or five at the most, some number. And then you just have the rest of the electrons, which you haven't actually put into the core states of the ions. You could do all that, and you'd still have a horrendously complicated problem. Now, I should say that, so if we were to just restrict our attention, so I guess if we just were to restrict our attention to, say, these things, the atoms and molecules are not so bad. You can pretty well do those. The gases, liquids, and solids, the gases are sort of nice, the liquids and solids and so forth, down to about the liquid crystals. Basically, then, what you're talking about are homogeneous, distinct phases of matter. Okay? I don't know if that you understand what I mean by that. I mean, a crystal, ideally, is a homogeneous macroscopic phase of matter. Okay. Now, when I wrote it down, I actually had a little note here that they could be perfect or imperfect. And of course, when they become imperfect, the properties become much more interesting. But basically, these things, did I put in magnets, ferromagnets, antiferromagnets? If you know the phase of the material of the substance that you're studying, that is, again, an enormous simplification, okay, if it's crystalline or metallic or semiconducting, then already you've built in an enormous amount of physics that it's difficult to get to from here, okay? So we're going to be, for the most part, talking about homogeneous macroscopic phases of matter. Now, the systems that we study will be characterized by a temperature, which could, in theory, be zero. And you've had a course in statistical mechanics, so I'm just going to remind you of a few thermodynamic or statistical mechanics things. Okay, systems. Okay, and actually, for the electronic systems, the chemical potential is also important. And this temperature characterizes a system which can exchange energy with a typically larger system, which is called a bath. Okay, and so you can imagine, well, you can imagine a lot of things. You can also call it a refrigerator, if you like, something that establishes a temperature. Okay, and in statistical mechanics or thermodynamics, you sort of work out that you've got this little system that's attached to this bath, which you could also call a refrigerator. But if you do low temperature physics, you for sure have that refrigerator there, which is defining the temperature, and your sample can sit there and exchange energy with the refrigerator or the bath in such a way that in equilibrium it's on average not exchanging any energy, and it has a well-defined temperature and so forth. Okay, and similarly, if you have a piece of metal or a sample, a little crystal of some interesting conducting material, and you solder or glue using a conducting cement leads onto it, and the leads are wires which are connected to the rest of your system, it's possible to exchange electrons, so you define a chemical potential for your system. And then when you bring in the fact that things are charged, it becomes more interesting and complicated, but we won't go there right now. Now, you're interested in average quantities associated with the material that you're studying, and these average quantities are determined by a probability distribution. Or you could call it a density matrix or a statistical matrix. And for a system which is in equilibrium at a temperature T, also called 1 over beta, this is e to the minus beta H over trace e to the minus beta h, where trace means trace over all the states of the system. Okay, so the point is that if you know this, and if you know how to calculate this trace, you can calculate any average property of your system, which is a function of temperature. Okay, so as you vary the temperature, you can calculate the properties of the system. That's what these things are good for, these probabilities. It's like the statistical mechanics generalization of wave functions. Okay, if you know wave functions, you can calculate expectation values. If you know density matrices, you can calculate thermal averages. Okay, I'm actually going to make use of another associated property of the system, which is that this density matrix can be derived from a variational principle, from a variation, from a function, or if you call it a functional, let's call it a free energy functional. Let's call it. I've been working on my notation here. And I apologize for the fact that I'm going to use rows and p's. And the difference is that little thing at the top, OK? Which is trace subject to trace, so probability distribution, so it's normalized to unit trace. And that this is minimized by, if you minimize over all possible probability distributions, that's the real free energy, which in the thermodynamics is E minus TS. Sorry for going down so low here. get rid of the theory of everything. It's also equal to so there's two things going on here. Okay, so this statement here is that there is a function or functional that you can write down, which is a functional of an arbitrary probability distribution, but it has in it the Hamiltonian that you want to solve. By solve, we mean find the probability, the real probability distribution for a system governed by this Hamiltonian in equilibrium at temperature T. Okay, so the statement is that the probability distribution that minimizes this thing is that. Okay, and if you like, you can think of it as that this thing is just cooked up so that it's minimized by that. And the reason, you may be shaking your head saying, why all this weird stuff? I mean, the whole point to this is that this is going to provide us with a framework for doing approximate calculations that describe the physical systems that we're interested in, since we already said we can't solve them exactly. Now, the free energy itself, I mean, just as an aside, which is a function of T and V and N, if you like. This is the thermodynamic potential function of these variables. If you know this, you can calculate properties of your system by taking derivatives. This is actually the Helmholtz free energy. So for instance, and this presumably you saw in your or many other thermodynamics classes, that S is minus T dF dT is the entropy. The pressure is minus dF dV at constant T and N. And the chemical potential is dF dN at T and V. And the specific heat, actually, specific heat's a good one, which you can express in different ways. The so-called specific heat at constant volume. So the whole point here is that if you can do a calculation which starts from your microscopic Hamiltonian, you calculate all the energy levels of the system. It's actually pretty much all you need. You get this statistical operator, or even just knowing this normalization here. You can calculate the free energy. And from that, you can obtain properties of the system. And the similar statements apply so this would be a grand potential function that involves temperature, chemical potential, and volume. And the point is that's for a system which is, as I described earlier, not only in contact with the temperature bath or refrigerator, but also in contact with a particle bath. Okay, so I don't want to dwell on any of this. You've all got books And you've had courses in thermodynamics, and so if you don't have it all in your head, you can look it up. So, but I do want to dwell on this. And the question is, how would you ever do this calculation? Say that you wanted to calculate the minimum value of this functional with respect to all possible probability distributions. How would you do it? Okay. Well, let's say that's easy in principle. So what you would do is you would write down a totally general probability distribution. Okay? And you can write that down very simply. You can parameterize it in terms of something here that I call a variational Hamiltonian. And this variational Hamiltonian is not to be confused with this, which is the real Hamiltonian. This is the problem you're trying to solve. Yeah?
So you take any general
exponential? Oh, because it has the nice properties that you want. It has the property that it's a probability operator. Okay, so it's going to have positive eigenvalues. It traces to one. It's just got all the. It's just a re-expression. Okay. Yeah.
So it's possible to write any probability distribution in this one?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's put it this way. I'm sort of working on that assumption. I think it's plausible enough when you think about it. And so the point is really that let me just mention that I often call this a fake Hamiltonian. And it just to help remind myself and everybody else that this is not to be confused with the real Hamiltonian of the problem that you're trying to solve. Okay? So just because this comes up all the time. And in fact, well, let's not go there. So the important thing is that this Hamiltonian should be an operator in the same Hilbert space, if you like, as this. Yeah. Yeah. With respect to, yeah, yeah. And this is just a re-expression of that we express this. Okay, so then this guy here is, we can write out like all possible kinds of terms that you could have in a Hamiltonian for that system, with parameters in front of each kind of term, okay? And then you minimize with respect to all of the parameters that you use to parameterize this. Okay. Why? Say, why don't I just write down this? And that's the answer. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Okay.
So that H doesn't mean, like, HV doesn't mean anything physical. It's just a parameter that you're varying, which gives you a varying set of P's, which you can minimize over. So why?
Yeah, except it isn't just a parameter. It's actually an operator in the Hilbert space of the system, which contains in it parameters which can be varied. I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, that as to what this has to do, if this has any relationship to the Hamiltonian of the real system, if you like. I mean,
I guess the question is why. You seem to you're not varying over all HV. You said you're only varying over HV, which could be conceivable Hamiltonians for your system. Is that right?
Which are in the Hilbert space of the. Yeah, in other words, which this is a if you. Say that you were dealing with a two-state system.
Okay.
So then this would be a Hermitian to our two matrix.
A positive, any positive Hermitian.
No, it doesn't. This isn't positive.
Okay, this just is, any Hermitian.
It's just a
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, if you're saying why in the world would you ever do this, let's just move on. Okay. So, I mean, in a sense, you know, you can solve Schrödinger's equation this way. I mean, right, you have some Hamiltonian with kinetic energy, for simple case, kinetic energy, potential energy. You write down some function, which looks like a generalized wave function, which satisfies your boundary conditions. And you minimize the expectation value of the Hamiltonian with respect to the variational freedom in that function. Now, if you picked a general enough function, you could get the right answer, exact answer. But in any case, you'll get an approximation to the ground state wave function. And in fact, if you were really good at doing that, you could find the ground state and then project that out and look at the and derive the excited states too. So in principle, if you could do that to arbitrary accuracy, you could get all the eigenstates just by the variational calculations. And in a sense, solving Schrodinger's equation is obviously it's equivalent to that. Okay, it's just not the way you think about it. When you solve some differential equation that satisfies boundary conditions, you don't think of that as doing a variational calculation. But these things are all related. Okay. Let's just go to the next step here, and maybe things will become a little bit clearer. Okay, so now a special case is something that I would, and I would argue that we should all call mean field theory. And my definition of mean field theory is simply that is you restrict your Hamiltonian, your variational Hamiltonian, to be the sum of one-body Hamiltonians. And if you do that, I can assure you that when you then go through the calculation for any system that you're familiar with, you will obtain what you will recognize, because I'm sure you've all done some calculation of this type, as the mean field equations for that system. Okay? So this is just a general specification of what you mean by mean field theory. It says that you're going to approximate the distribution function of the density matrix of the system by the, if you like, the exponential of sum of one body Hamiltonians, and you're going to optimize, you're going to find the best possible form for this. And that will be the best mean field solution for that problem. Yes, sir.
Can we express the probability distribution as in terms of a variational Hamiltonian? We said that the variational Hamiltonian was sort of a fake Hamiltonian, which is just a variable and not really representing the system.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're sort of dividing it into like particles, which is a physical thing.
Mm-hmm.
What's the correspondence?
Okay, well, there's a, what's the correspondence? Okay, so I was free to choose anything for this. Okay. I decided to consider this. Now, this is likely to have the property that this problem here, this one-body Hamiltonian, is almost always going to be something that I can solve exactly, even for a Hamiltonian that contains parameters in it. It'll be something that I can solve exactly. Whereas any more complicated form, like sums of two-body Hamiltonians and things like that, I probably can't solve, or maybe I can solve the two-body one, but I can't solve the three-body one, so forth. Okay. So a nice feature of this, as a special case of this, is that I can solve the one-body problem exactly. There is a huge loss of generality. Maybe I used the wrong term here. Sorry. This is not solving the problem anymore, okay? This is an approximate solution. Marius. Yes, arbitrary dimension, arbitrary number of particles.
Yeah, because in one dimension, the mean field theory is wrong. In one dimension, the mean field theory is completely wrong because it predicts space transitions.
Yeah, so I'm not going to tell you that this is going to give you the right answer. As you point out correctly, for one-dimensional systems, this gives you physically misleading, not totally misleading, okay? But if you just said, I'm going to solve the one-dimensional problem by mean field theory, here's how it works, that would be wrong, okay? In two dimensions, it's pretty iffy. In three dimensions, it's still, you know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not so good. It's particularly bad if you're close to a phase transition. Okay. However, you may recall that the first part of this course is going to be on the normal state of the Fermi liquid, and actually. We won't encounter any phase transitions this week.
The lambda exponentials, they're working fine in field theory for like five dimensions or more?
Four, depending on the nature of the system.
Three.
Yeah. Three is, yeah. On the other hand, when you say work, okay, you're talking about, well, the one-dimensional case, which is pathological because mean field theory predicts that there's a phase transition at finite temperature for systems that would have a phase transition, say like the Eisenman model or something like that. The other thing, by the way, the one-dimensional systems you can almost always solve exactly, so it's not that much of a deal, okay? But the other point that I would make is that say that you're working in three dimensions, but you're not close to a phase transition. This is actually pretty good. Okay, it's only when you have a phase transition where this thing breaks down in D less than 4. So, I suppose it's because you have diverging length scales and stuff, or diverging fluctuations, or fluctuations at all length scales, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But in any case, we're not solving that problem today. Okay, I mean, for the normal Fermi liquid, which is actually rather benign at low temperatures, except that it can have some instabilities. If you have the normal Fermi liquid with repulsive interactions in three dimensions, you go down to low temperatures, you're not going to encounter any phase transitions except for possibly superconductivity or, well, okay, but just emphasize that. Okay. I should say that this Hamiltonian will, in general, contain a potential function which models the effect of the interactions of this one particle with all the other particles. And that, if you like, is your mean field. So what about quantum statistics? If your particles are distinguishable or classical, then everything factors. Or if they're labeled by lattice sites, say it's in magnetic insulators, then everything factors and you have a bunch of independent problems. Hamiltonians here. If you have identical particles, then the density matrix will correspond to some Slater determinants, anti-symmetric functions, and anti-symmetric products of one particle functions. That problem, so when you solve this for fermions, that's called Hartree-Fock. And we'll do that, hopefully, briefly in another lecture. And that incorporates so-called exchange effects, exchange of fermions. Okay. The other comment that I would make, say, since we're talking about metals, is that non-interacting fermions provide a perfectly fine Hilbert space for you to work with. Okay, it's just that they're a long way from the correct answer. So I'd like to spend a few minutes. I'm almost on time here, but I think we're going to fall slightly behind on non-interacting fermions. So I get to go till when, Dennis? Is it 5 after? Or? I started at 10 after? OK, great. So I think we're in business. Good. OK, so let's look at non-interacting fermions, the Hamiltonian. I'm going to write this way. This is a Q with a vector. I have troubles with my writing. I'm going to put the chemical potential in. That's it. OK, so the main purpose of doing all this is to establish notation. I want to make sure that we're all using the same terminology here. OK, so where do I want to start? Q. Okay, this is a way. Okay, so I don't know whether any of your other courses would have written the Hamiltonian this way, as a sum over discrete Q vectors. Maybe not. Okay. So I'm going to work in a box. A volume B, which I'll call L cubed. And actually, I'm going to use periodic boundary conditions just to make all of our lives easy. Periodic boundary conditions just means you come right back on yourself. Actually, it's not totally unphysical. There's a lot of great metals physics that's done on little metal rings. Okay, so let's stick to that. And the wave functions. Are. Let's call it psi q of r 1 over root v e to the I q dot r. Okay, and because I used periodic boundary conditions, I can tell you what these q's are. Zero, plus or minus one. minus 2. I is x, y, z, or however many letters you want to use for the dimensionality that you're in. Okay? So these are just waves that come back on themselves. And that means that each component of your wave vector is discrete, separated by 2 pi over L. Yeah?
If the boundary conditions weren't periodic, what would change?
Then your wave functions would be real. And you'd have like standing waves in a box, say. Okay, it's just a little bit more convenient. Also, if you want to calculate things like the current going around, the periodic boundary conditions are nice.
And do they usually give the same answers, though?
But the answers shouldn't depend on the boundary conditions, because we're talking about microscopic samples. But for calculating things and for counting, which is something that we do a lot of, it's just a convenient thing to use. Okay, not totally unphysical. I'm going to take d equals 3 for simplicity. And these operate. OK, so that's these. And these operators so this is an anti-commutator, c, q, sigma, c dagger, q prime, sigma prime. Okay, no problem with this, right? Yeah. A few quantum field theory courses, and you're up to speed. Okay, and then there's the other commutators with two daggers or with no daggers, which are 0. Yeah,
and R are position.
Position. This is okay. The wave function is a function of position.
Yeah, but also in your Hamiltonian.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the Qs are, they're like momentum. Okay. Okay, and I'm going to call this.
Wasn't the sigma the spin?
Those are spins. Yeah, that's an extra label, which will be plus or minus 1 or plus or minus a half or whatever. It takes on 2 values. Yeah.
Of two vectors related to the
it's a product of delta x, qx, qx prime, delta qy, qy prime.
Okay, so it's the same thing as the delta functions. So it's the same thing as the delta function?
It's a chronic delta. These are chronic delta.
I mean, I'm asking, is it related to the Dirac delta?
Dirac delta function. Ah, yes. Okay. Yeah, so you can, I do this in undergraduate courses where you take the limit as the lattice constant goes to 0 and keeping the size of your system the same and going from Kronecker, this type of thing, to Dirac delta functions. But Dirac delta functions, you know, it's like you can divide space up into infinitely fine, you know, it's sort of, you know, we don't need that problem. So one of the things I like to say is that in condensed matter physics, you have no ultraviolet divergences because you have your lattice constant or the size of your atom. And you have no infrared divergences because you work in a box. And so in a sense, everything's, and that's not totally true, of course, because sometimes you find that quantities depend in a weird way on the size of the unit cell or the size of the box that's unphysical, and then you say, okay, I do have problems with divergences. But okay, the averages are just things like the other ones, or if they're different, they're 0. And so this is if the state is empty, let's call that this is a relative probability. This thing is just writing the kinetic energy as, call it epsilon q. And this is just it's called n of and this thing here is basically a step function around mu. Whose width is t, 1 over beta. So when t is 0, it's a step function. That's the Fermi distribution function. And so then you can calculate quantities like that. You can calculate the number for the system at a chemical potential. In both of those cases, the sum over sigma is just gives you a 2, because nothing depends on the spin. It's a constant if it's a constant. If the number of particles is a constant, then mu varies with temperature and volume. So you have two possibilities. You hold the system at constant mu, and then you can calculate these averages. Or you hold the system, you separate it from the reservoir, you hold it at constant n, change the temperature, you'll find that the chemical potential changes. OK, so those are the two possibilities. These things here are, yeah, I think you'll look at that a little bit this afternoon. So I just wanted to go through a little bit of algebra here. I apologize, but just again, to make sure that we're all on the same page. If you want to calculate a sum over q, how do you do it? Well, actually, you really want to turn it into an integral. Okay, and to turn it into an integral, you just let me just write this. Okay, and this just comes from knowing what the interval is between each of the components from one q vector to the next is 1 over 2 pi times the lattice constant. I've set the lattice constant equal to 1 here, by the way. Say what? No, OK. I'm sorry, who's asking this? Oh, Akosa. Or no. Here. So I mean, this has no dimensions, and this has no dimensions. OK, so if you wanted to turn this into a, if you don't have any angular dependence, then you can write this as 4 pi b over 2 pi q integral q squared dq. And then, because we're sort of running out of time, but I'd like to turn this, you know that e of q is h bar squared q squared over 2m. So let's just change this from an integral dq into an integral d energy. And what you get is let's write this correctly. And then I think we're going to have to stop. Okay, that's what it turns out to be. Okay, all of this assumes that you've got something on the right-hand side that you're integrating with something. Okay, and the point that I'd like to make is that this thing, without the integral, is the density of states. Okay, and maybe I'll have to stop here, and there'll be some discussion of this in the tutorial this afternoon, but let me just make three comments about the density of states. It goes like the size of the system. The number of states goes like the size of the system. It goes like root epsilon in D equals 3. And you can easily figure out what it goes like in other dimensions. And it goes like m to the 3 halves in D equals 3. Okay? So what that means is that heavy particles have a larger density of states. Or if you turn it around, systems that have large density of states per band describe or correspond to heavy particles. And in fact, in electron theory, there's heavy fermion systems which have extremely heavy particles. OK, so I've already gone over time, so maybe we should stop there. OK. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, how come there's no cutoff for the momentum up there in the cubes? Why are you integrating from?
Oh, because we haven't. This one here?
Yeah.
Because we're still working in free space.
Okay, but
so we have. If we'll put it on a lattice next time, and then there'll be a cutoff, and then yeah. I just want to do one at a time. Anything else? Okay.